To read up on all the details, redeyescreations.com. Follow us on a regular basis. Today we are going to focus on the very strange alien encounter case of Rickard Höglund, one of Sweden's very few reported contact cases. With us to do that we have Håkan Blomqvist, who have been working with AFU, the Archive for UFO Research, since 1973 here in Sweden. He is the author of three books, UFO in Myth and Reality, Strangers on Our Earth, that we are going to discuss here today. And his latest one is A Trip Through Time, UFO Sweden's History, 1970 to 2010. These are primarily available in Swedish at the moment. UFOarchives.blogspot.se, afu.se and ufo.se are some of the websites that we have linked up for you on redeyescreations.com also. This is a very unusual case, so stay with us for some interesting and off-the-wall stuff. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Håkan Blomqvist, a neighbor to me up here in the north, of course, in Sweden. It's good to have you on the program. Thank you for making some time and talking with us today, Håkan.
Yeah, thank you, Henrik, and I'm glad to be on your program.
You bet. This is going to be interesting. Regular listeners might recall that we did a program with Carl Svahn from UFO Sweden about a year or so ago, and today, of course, we're going to kind of continue on the topic of Swedish ufology and discuss a few of the contact cases that there are from this country. There are very few, and we're going to get into that later, why that might be as well. But we certainly have many areas that we can get into. And I just thought, though, that we could briefly touch upon your background a little bit in the work of you know, in the UFO field, basically, when you got involved with the AFU. This is in English, that would be the Archive for Research, UFO Research. This is actually the biggest one in the world currently, which is interesting in itself. But tell us a little bit about your background, Håkan.
Yes, well, I've been into UFO research for more than 40 years. I started in 1970 when I was 18 and formed my first group in Södertälje, where I lived at that time. And in 1973, we formed AFU, Archives for UFO Research. Then we was just a small group, an informal group. And we started with just two bookshelves. We wanted to create a basis, a foundation for research, UFO research in Sweden. And it was a very modest beginning. We had two bookshelves in a small apartment in Södertälje, and we basically wanted to do serious research. And to do this, you have to have data. You have to have material. There was no archive in Sweden at that time. There was no. If you wanted a report, you have to start from scratch. So we thought we tried to build a foundation for serious UFO research in Sweden. And we continued and collected books, and we got more and more books. And in 1980, we moved to Norrköping, where I'm living now. And the archive grew, and we had to make it a formal private foundation in 1980. And from then on, it has become bigger and bigger, and we are now the largest UFO archive and library in the world. We have nine premises with 444 square meters, and that's quite a lot of material.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So how did this happen in that sense? You just started collecting material and gathering more and more and more, and eventually it just grew and grew, or was this an intention from day one, Håkan?
Well, in a way, it was a dream, of course, in the beginning, but we had no idea that it would grow to these dimensions. But we became more and more known, and people started donating books and magazines and other things to us. And we became also more and more known internationally, so we received more donations from other countries, from several ufologists. And this, of course, made it possible to really start some serious UFO research. And today we have about 20,000 books and about 40,000 magazine copies, thousands of UFO reports, and we collect generally everything about UFOs, you know, everything for paraphernalia. We create novels that has to do with UFOs. We create bumper stickers, T-shirts, toys, anything. So maybe we can start a museum also.
Ah, okay. Very good. Is there any discrepancy, any kind of, I guess, judgment in terms of what you do accept, or is it merely as long as there's a, you know, reference to UFOs in there, it's pretty much acceptable, or how does that go?
Yeah, well, in this respect, we are unique because we collect everything from data from the authorities, from the military, to the most extreme sects and cults you can imagine. We collect everything for research. So that means that today we have many students coming to us who want to do a thesis on comparative religion or, well, anything. Any subject, because we collect material from all over the field. We don't we have no restrictions.
Oh, okay, well that's very good. In that sense, you want to have material about basically anything from, as you said, from UFO cults to basically how this has gotten itself into the, you know, pop culture and in modern lore, in a sense. But how much of this material are you aware of, in a sense? Obviously, it's impossible to go through it all, but have you gone through quite a bit there? Or I mean, much of it is maybe in languages you don't read or write in either, of course, but in terms of the Swedish and the English primarily, those material, have you gone through it?
Yeah, we collect material from all countries and all languages, and we try to collect 3 copies of every book on UFOs from every country, in every edition, in every language. So that means quite a lot of books.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. So the website that we can give out right away here is afu.se or afu.info. And how I think I asked Klaus Vaughn this a while back, but maybe you can remind me and our listeners, how is the online reference here? Are you're currently digitizing this material as well? Is that correct?
Yes. We are working very hard now to try to digitize as much as possible to put it on the Internet, and that is one of our main projects at the time, because we have so much material and so little is still digitized, so we are working hard on this now.
So obviously a little bit later here we're going to get into your own work in all of this, your own research. You have 3 books out there. Currently, primarily anyway, in Swedish, nothing available in English as of yet. We can talk about possible translations or how this is going to work in with some of Timothy Good's material a little bit later. But with all the things that you've been gone through then, and you've been researching this and back since the 70s, is there any way you can give us a kind of a rundown on your conclusion, I guess, of the subject matter? It's a very difficult one. It's very elusive, and it's a lot of different kind of material when it comes to the quality out there. Some seems very fantastic, while other material seems very, you know, down to earth and very, you know, believable. But break it down for us, if you can, about what you think about the subject overall, Håkan.
Oh, well, that's a large question. But basically, I think the UFO phenomenon, when you have taken away the misidentifications and so on, you have there are several types of UFO phenomena from probably entirely different sources, but some of these sources seem to be that we are not alone on this planet. There seems to be somebody else here with a technology that we do not have, and I think that is the most fascinating aspect of this. But of course the UFO phenomenon is very complicated, and there are many fakes, there are many possible ways to determine the probabilities, but basically I think there is another intelligence behind some of these phenomena, and I think that is the really exciting thing about it.
Absolutely, you bet. The possibility is what if, and of course, as some other people have argued, it only takes one of all these, you know, thousands and thousands of cases that are reported, both of the sighting of a UFO itself to actually a contact. It only takes one of these to be authentic for the whole phenomena to be the real thing. So people shouldn't dismiss it that quickly.
No, that's right. I think this subject deserves serious research because it is very special, very complicated. And I have given four reasons for private research. I think this research must be done by private foundations. I don't think that any government can do this in a good way. And the reason for this is, first of all, it is scientifically very controversial. It has no academic status, this subject. And if you are into academic research, you will probably not get economic
right, you want to get
money for research,
I guess. For your research.
And you will probably be ridiculed by your colleagues.
Right.
It's a tricky subject. If you really want to do real research, and when with real research, I mean you go out to the field, investigate, and interview the witnesses, not just reading books and decide from that. And it's also it's a military controversial subject. If you're going to do real research into this subject, you have to also study secret military projects, spy planes, remotely piloted vehicles, intelligence organizations, false flag operations, and all of that. And
yeah.
Of course, that's not very popular if you do.
Right.
And the third is, it's politically very controversial. I mean, any politician today who would try to say, I would like money for serious research, I don't think he would stay a politician very long. So very few people know anything about the serious side of this subject, so it would be politically impossible, I think. Fourth, I think, is that this subject is also controversial from a religious point of view, not so much here in Northern Europe, perhaps, but when you come to the USA and other countries, it is a very controversial topic, and we can see that in our archives. We have many books from basically Christian fundamentalists who think that UFOs are demons or satanic origins or something. So I think you have another problem there. And there are four reasons why I think this research, UFO research, must be done by private foundations. That's the only way ahead.
That's right. And of course, speaking of the religiosity connected to the subject matter, this is there are so many different, twists and turns to this, because now, of course, we have researchers going into the biblical, you know, reference works and actually connecting the UFO phenomena to some of the, you know, ancient accounts that some of the, patriarchs had and such with these things. So there's all kinds of angles here in terms of ancient aliens and also the Nephilim connection, if you will, as well. So it's very, very interesting. But where do you think this subject is heading and going? Because of course we've been struggling for so many years in that sense to figure it out, and it seems the more and more we try, the kind of almost the further away from the subject we get, and there is no conclusive 100% positive evidence to the actuality of the subject matter. It's very elusive. It's very, very difficult. But what do you think, after you've been going through a lot of this material? Are we going to, is it actually heading somewhere? Are we going to get a conclusion, a definitive answer on this, Håkan?
Well, eventually I think we will get an answer, but I'm not sure it will be during my lifetime. It is very complicated, and of course it has to do with what actually is behind the UFO phenomenon, and if there is an intelligence behind it, what are their plans? We really don't know. Today we have more data. We know more about this phenomenon. We know about the effects on people and about from UFOs and so on. We have more data to work on. But of course, basically, we really don't know what is going on.
That's the bottom line. That's why it's still an interesting subject in that sense, about why it attracts so many people to it. It's a genuine mystery. And of course, we shouldn't discount people's testimony as well, witnesses. And of course, we can. It can be more difficult when it comes to, I guess, sightings of an unidentified flying object, because as you detailed earlier, this could be basically anything. We have Black Ops military programs running. We have, all kinds of possibilities of what might be seen by certain people. But when it comes to the The contact phenomena, though, that's obviously into the realm of a different area, and I don't understand, with so many thousands of people around the world reporting this, that this still hasn't gotten a good, proper, you know, investigation. Because I've also argued, if nothing else, it's a subject matter that should touch upon psychology. Then, if you come to this from a scientific point of view and a non-believer point of view, I guess, then there's something happened to the human psyche. There's people who are having these experiences, and that must be for a reason. So the other question I always had is, why don't someone or institutions, medical, what have you, actually research the phenomena as such? What do you think, Håkan?
Yeah, I think that it's a strange. That's very strange. I always wonder how come that there are so few ufologists in the international UFO research community that are actually documenting and investigating the complicated physical contact cases. There are very few, even if you look at it in an international perspective. We have Timothy Good in England. He has done some good research in documenting things. But there are very, very few serious ufologists who try to document the contact cases. And maybe it's because they are so extremely complicated and controversial that they don't really like to touch it. It's a very tricky subject. But I think it's unfortunate, because many of the early contactees from the 1950s, you have George Adamski, Howard Menger, Orfeo Angelucci, and others, the people who were involved with these are now soon gone, and a lot of data will simply disappear. And I don't understand why our American colleagues are not trying to document these cases and interview all the people who knew something about this. I find it rather strange, really.
Okay, good point. See if there are some people out there who are actually, you know, doing it or willing to do it or whatever. But I want to get into some of the aspects that you write about, of course, in your books, primarily Strangers on Our Earth. The Swedish title is Främlingar på vår jord, and you detail some of the more interesting contact cases specifically than in Sweden. Now, the first question I guess I'd like to ask you is about the number of cases. There are very few here compared to the United States, compared to South American countries. I don't have too much of a clue, like what's happening in Russia or China, for instance. I don't hear much about that, or Africa even. But why do you think there are so few cases in Sweden, Håkan?
Well, I must say that's a question I also wondered about. I really don't know. We have a few cases here, but of course, if you go to the United States or England or other countries, there are many more. But we do have cases here, and I have also heard about other cases which I have not been able to investigate because the people didn't want to be investigated. So there are cases, there are physical contact cases even here in Sweden, but they are few, and I have no answer to that.
Could it be a cultural thing? In other words, this is not something a more timid, laid-back Scandinavian is prone to discuss with their peers. What do you think, Håkan?
Well, probably Sweden is a very small country, and in a global perspective, we are almost nothing. I mean, we are a small country, so I guess other intelligence would be more interested in the large nations, England and America and so forth.
Could it also be that a part of this subject actually has to do with military programs running black ops? And as we know, the United States and NATO countries, of course, are primarily have a really large defense budget and a large black ops budget as well. What's that angle in all this, do you think?
Well, I think there is probably a connection here also. There are many rumors, of course, of black projects and secret designs for UFOs and so forth. And there are many rumors about this. But we don't have these kind of rumors here in Sweden, not that I know of course. So this seems to be, well, it's in the United States and Britain and so on. Maybe we are just too small.
Could be. Let's talk about the case first here then of Richard Höglund. This is, of course, a very close name, Richard Höglund, but people shouldn't make the connection to the name here. Tell us when you got involved with this case, when you heard about this, and then a little bit later, maybe we can just kind of break down about exactly what happened and how much you know about the case.
Yeah. Well, first of all, this is the most interesting and also the most complicated UFO contact case I have ever investigated, and I have spent several years documenting this. I first heard of this in 1972 when I was just 20 years old and very new into ufology, from some friends here in Sweden. And from the beginning, I thought this was a very fascinating contact because it was very physical and there were many people involved, and it was unusual in that respect that here you had a Swedish man who obviously worked for these aliens, whoever wherever they come from, whoever they are. And so I started to gather material to document this as much as I could, and I continued with this during the years and tried to interview as many witnesses as I could. But of course I was very young when I started doing this, and the main witness, Richard Höglund, he died in 1977. I only had a short telephone conversation with him, unfortunately. But basically, this story started in 1965. Richard Höglund, he was a Swedish worker, a rock blaster by profession, and he lived in Uddevalla, not far from Gothenburg, with his wife and a dog. And he was on sick leave here. He had trouble with his kidneys, a stone, kidney stone. Mm-hmm. And so he was home from work, and it was on the December the 9th, 1965, which was a very cold day. And he decided to take his car to a lake called Grindhultsjön, about 8 kilometers east of Uddevalla, for a walk with a dog. And he takes the dog onto the lake. There is ice on the lake there. And suddenly his dog starts running around in circles like mad. So he had to put a leash on it. And he hears a sound in the sky, like a whining sound in the air. And as he looks up, he notices an object, a round or saucer-shaped object, about 5 meters in diameter and 3 meters in height, which is spiraling down on the ice, not very close to him, coming down. And his first shock was that this must be some Russian cosmonauts or something. And the object comes, it doesn't land on the ice, it hovers a little bit above the ice, and under this object, there is a tube lowered by some a dark tube, and with some material made of soft material, which is moving in the wind. And he is close enough to feel a breeze of hot air from this. And a funny thing is that this air has a smell of flowers, of hyacinth, mm-hmm. it's called. So he's just looks at this, and suddenly you see 4 people coming down this tube like on an invisible elevator, and come down on the ice, and they come up to him. And when they are quite close to him, he can see that they are no ordinary people. They are 3 men and 1 woman. And the very strange thing about this is that they are enclosed in some form of transparent overall or some plastic overalls, which looks like they are air pressured from within.
Mm-hmm.
And what is very special is, of course, they are totally naked under this. And he, of course, really don't know what to think about this. They come up to him and start a sign conversation. They were basically normal in the way that they normal height like people, but they have very large dark eyes. They were somewhat slanted eyes, somewhat oriental, and they were perfect in a way. They were perfect teeth. They were perfect skin. There were no blemishes. They were absolutely hairless. No hair on their bodies, not even genital hair. But they looked like people generally.
Mm-hmm.
With one exception, then. Their ears were rather large and a little bit pointed. And the hole into the head was larger than on ordinary humans. He compared it to looking at a cat. You can see quite, if you look at a cat, you can see almost inside the head.
Right.
Yeah. And they start to a sort of conversation there, gesticulating and writing in the snow and so on. And he is not really afraid of them. They seem friendly. They point to his hair and seem to be very fascinated by his hair. He has to remove his cap several times, and they laugh and point at his hair, which is obviously very strange to them. When he tried to touch their overalls or their plastic covers, then they moved away very quickly. They didn't want to be touched, and they had a small black package which they sprayed some form of gas on everything they touched themselves. For instance, the girl started playing with the dog, and before she played with the dog, she sprayed him with this gas, or whatever it was. Richard thought this was very strange, because the dog was usually very aggressive. But this girl, she played with the dog, and it was no problem.
So there's some kind of disinfectant or something like that they probably spray on?
Yeah, probably, yes. Yeah, it looks like some form of disinfectant, yes. and another thing, they didn't walk on the ground. It was like they floated a little bit above the ground when they weren't. They were not on there was like an invisible air under their feet when they walked. They had some form of broad black bracelets with a yellow button on their left wrists. And when they touched this, which they did occasionally, it seemed to have something to do with this weightlessness. That was his experience. They tried to communicate here, and there is one man who is older, and the two men are obviously very young, and the girl is also quite young. And the old man, he explains that he knows something about this earth. He shows how you hunt with a bow and arrow, and they try to converse about basic things on this planet.
Sorry to interrupt, but do you know if this was in Swedish then? Was it telepathic nature, or is it still with the signs?
No, he doesn't say it was telepathic. They drew figures in the snow, and they gesticulated, and they tried to, no telepathy here. So he didn't mention that anywhere. When they have talked for a while, Richard felt that his pain in the kidneys affected him. And this was noticed by this older man. So he goes back to the craft and up in the ship again, and comes back with a small cylinder. Mm-hmm. And he goes behind Richard and sort of let it sort of glide on his back, or touches his back. And then the pain just is gone away. He doesn't feel the pain anymore. This is interesting, because we know today we have a technology that you can, by sound waves, destroy kidney stones. So that's my speculation, of course, that maybe they did something to him that simply destroyed these stones, because he had been to the doctor and been x-rayed, and they had found that he had stones in his kidneys, which of course troubled him.
Do you know if this later then was confirmed in any way, like by the doctor, that it was just removed or gone after this point?
Yeah, and that's interesting. I corresponded with the doctor in Uddevalla who did this investigation. He had an x-ray before this happened, and I have got all the data on this. it shows clearly it has he has some stones in the kidneys. And after this, he did a new X-ray on, I think, the 20th of December, and there is absolutely nothing left in the kidney. It's like it's never been a stone in the kidney. So something did happen, whatever. It just disappeared, and his pain disappeared. If it was some natural way it could have gone out, I don't know, but it was gone, simply.
Yeah. You mentioned Helge before. This is Helge. This is what he was called, before he I guess he came out with his real name, right? This was actually covered in one of the newspapers at the time, and it's called Helge. Helge Case.
Yeah. It took some time before I mentioned his real name. Then we called him Helge. So it's known as the Helge Case in Sweden. But his actual name was Richard Höglund, of course.
What was some of the? Have you gone through some of the newspaper coverage of this in the early days there?
You mean if there were other observations that day or something?
No, if this was touched upon by some of the local press in the area, or did he contact anybody about this newspaper?
Yeah. Well, what happened after this? There's much more to this. They leave eventually, though, of course, and this craft leaves, and he goes home, and he didn't dare to tell his wife during the first days what had happened. He thought it was so strange, actually. But after a few days, he had heard about UFO organizations. There was a UFO organization in Stockholm called Ufologiska Sällskapet, Ufological Society, and he contacted a man that is the chairman there. And he came down for an interview, and I had this interview on tape, which is one of the basic documentations on this case.
Mm-hmm.
So, shall we continue with his
I guess
experience?
So, because there's a lot more to it. Did you just remind me again, though, Håkan, did you interview Richard personally?
Yes, only one time in 1973. I phoned him, and he said he was not allowed to tell anything about this. He said it will probably be known in the future, but he had been told not to tell anybody about this. It was I think he was afraid, but that was I heard from other people. And he didn't want to talk about it. So he said he had written a book about it himself. He had a manuscript, but I have never seen this, and it's probably gone if he ever wrote about it.
Was he told not to talk about this by the contacts he had with the people, those people?
Yeah.
Or,
by these aliens, he was told that not to talk about this. He had talked quite a lot to several ufologists in the beginning after this first experience. But he was told that he should not do this. They didn't like it, he said.
So phone interview, Håkan, that's obviously a little bit different from meeting in person and so, but still, though, your overall impression when you talked of him, stable, all that, or how did he come across to you at the time?
Yeah, he seemed like any normal man. It was quite okay. And, of course, I have several sources then for his experiences. One, his best friend, which was called Gösta Johansson, is one of my main sources to this, who he told just about everything to. And I have interviewed many, many people who knew him, of course, and some of his closest friends also.
So what about his wife, though, as well? She knew a little bit eventually, is that correct?
Yeah, eventually he told about this, and she believed him, but thought, of course, it was very strange because he knew that he was a down-to-earth person. He was a rock blaster and a worker. You know, he was down to earth in many respects.
Right.
So she thought this was very strange, of course. Mm-hmm. And there was one funny thing when he came home from this first experience. He smelled of flowers. He smelled of hyacinth. So his wife asked him, "Have you bought flowers for the Christmas already?" And of course he had to say, "No, I haven't." So he couldn't tell that it came from the craft, of course.
Oh, it's from an alien craft. I just biggie. Yeah,
yeah. That's a funny little thing.
That's
about
right. So there are some twists and turns. They continue up as this story. So let's kind of proceed and talk about what happened next here, Håkan.
Yeah. He continued working as a rock blaster, and in August 1966, which was about a year later then, he worked north of Uddevalla, and during the night when he was going home the next day, he felt very strange. He felt like he was almost forced to get up and go to the car and go back to the lake where he had his first contact. He said it was like almost somebody else drove my car. And so he dressed and he drives down to this lake one more time. And when he comes there, he observes there is a craft hovering over this lake again. And he can also see that there is a man standing beside the craft, but he's standing in the air like he was not affected by gravity, like he was weightless there. And there is a small boat there, and he takes this boat out just a few meters and out to this man. And they start a conversation. And now they speak Swedish, but the strange thing is that he doesn't hear it from his lips, but the sound comes from the craft a little bit after he has spoken, like there was some form of synchronized, some form of technical
translator device, what have you.
Yeah. some type of translator device, yes. Hmm. So the words came a little bit slightly afterwards. And here, Richard is informed or asked if he wants to cooperate with these people because there is, they say there is a war maybe coming, that the United States will possibly attack China, they say, and we need to start a peace movement. We would like your help. And he is also given a small plate, a metal plate, with some hieroglyphics on, strange signs on, that he is told to keep all the time. But, of course, Richard says, I don't know English. I'm just an ordinary worker. I don't want to do this, because he is also told to go to their base in the Bahamas for education. And of course he says, that's impossible. I work here, I have a wife, and I don't want to go to the Bahamas. So he thinks this is just nonsense.
Right.
Yeah, so they talk for a while, and he takes the boat back to the shore. And as he thinks this, the whole story is just crazy. Small plate he buries in the ground, in the woods there, beside the lake. And he goes home after this. And then after this, he starts thinking about all this, and he tells his wife. And he changes his mind. After a while, as they have obviously cured him for his sickness, he feels maybe I should help them. And so he starts discussing with his wife, perhaps I should go to the Bahamas and see what it's all about. But of course his wife says, this is crazy, I will never leave my home, and she doesn't like it at all, of course, she's protesting against this. And but I say I think I have to go. This is important. He feels sort of some form of obligation to them because they have helped him then.
Mm-hmm.
What happened next is he goes down. He had two daughters from a former marriage, and he goes down. They live in Göteborg, Gothenburg. And a couple of months after this, he goes to visit them, and he takes his car, and on his way home, he picks up this plate. He goes to the lake, picks up the plate, and when he stops at the gas station to fill up the car with gas again, a man comes up to him who looks like a priest or a Catholic priest. He has a dark clothes, dark cape and things like that, and he asks if he can go with him. And he says, well, it's okay, you can go with me. And after a while, this man asks, do you recognize me? And now I think I've left some out in this to make it understand it.
Oh, okay, do you need to go back again maybe?
Yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, ahead. That's right, that's right. that's right. Of course, the first time that they went to the Bahamas in March 1967 for the first time. I forgot that.
Right. So they actually went both Richard and his wife.
Yeah, he convinced her that we simply have to go, and so they sold everything they had. They sold the car. They had they had to kill the dog and sell everything they had because they. To go to the Bahamas, they were just ordinary workers and didn't have so much money. And they went to the Bahamas and to an island called Little Exuma. And there nothing happened because he hadn't the plate with him this time. Because of that, we learn later that nothing happened. So he wrote in the sand, I have been here, and his name, and then they have to go home again.
So, what was he? Did they detail him exactly where to go in the Bahamas?
Yeah, he was going to a beach in Little Exuma, and there to meet all these aliens. But he hadn't the plate with him, and nothing happened. So they had to go home again, which of course was very bad for that. They couldn't go back to Uddevalla. They didn't know what the neighbors would say. That would be very strange. Richard had a brother in Stockholm. So they moved into his apartment in Stockholm. And after a while, he also got a job as a rock blaster in Stockholm. So they could settle down a little bit there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it was now that he decided to go and fetch the plate and visit his daughters at the same time. When he met this guy who looked like a priest, he said that you forgot the plate the last time you were there. So he was obviously one of them somehow.
Was this encounter in Stockholm or in Uddevalla?
No, it was when he stopped at a gas station. And this man came up to him and asked for a lift. And obviously he was one of them, because he knew what had happened in the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he said, you forgot the plate, and that was not very good. Now you have to go again, and you have to take the plate with you this time.
Oh, jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. So, that's the second time they went. It was in December 1968.
So a few years after her, basically, yeah?
Yeah. And, of course, then several people had got involved in this case in various ways, because he was ordered to start a peace movement in Sweden. And he tried to start an ordinary organization, a peace movement here.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually started by a man in Nyköping. And this organization was called the New Generation to work for peace on Earth and things like that. And there were several UFO-interested people involved in this from the beginning. And there was also one man here who had quite a lot of money, and he said, "I can, if this is very good, I can finance another trip to the Bahamas, if this is something very good." And so they go to Bahamas once again in December 1968. And this time he has to plate with them. And he has been ordered that they should live in Nassau in the Bahamas. And on the New Year's Eve, he has to go down to the beach and meet a special man who is called Joe, a colored man, who will be waiting with a boat to take him to their base in the Bahamas. Hmm. And he does so. He goes to this meeting and meet this man, and there's also a girl there, and they go out in this boat, and he doesn't know how far out they go, but eventually they come to some mountain or some island, which there is a cave which they go into, and there they have a base, obviously, where he is to be taught various things. And he says it was very large, and he saw other entities there, some like us and some, well, very different from us, he said. And there he says he was taught what he was to do, but he says very little of this. I haven't been finding out very much about it, actually.
This is, in other words, nothing you have looked at on a map to see where this could be. It's off from Nassau, you said, but you don't know exactly where, is that correct?
No. And he said something also that he didn't want actually to tell the exact location of the base, so probably it wasn't where he's so outside Bahamas. It could have been somewhere else around there, as he didn't want to, well, disclose where the base was, actually.
Right.
Yeah. And when he came home to his wife after this, he was very agitated. He said it was, well, it was such an experience that it was hard for him to describe. But he has also said that he didn't want to tell so much to his wife, because she was not really a part of this. And he was afraid also for these beings or entities. They were pretty tough, he said. They were not, you couldn't say no to them, sort of.
Interesting.
Yeah. And this makes him a little bit different from all the other contactees who were more missionary and saying that they are good guys, they are here to help us and so on. But Richard said many times that he really didn't trust them. He didn't know if they were good, the good guys or the bad guys. And this makes him very different from ordinary contactees. He said he felt more forced to work for him, like there was some secret organization in some way.
Interesting. So obviously this is not an abduction case, but it's a voluntary process from Richard's side, and he agrees to all this. And it's more of a contact experience, but yet at the same time he feels that there's an element of being forced just to go along with the orders that they give him, basically.
Yeah, no, that's right. He doesn't really trust them. He said, I don't know. He said to one of his friends, I don't know if these are devils or angels, really. But he said they were pretty tough, and they had a lot of money, like some form of, well, almost mafia organization or something.
Interesting.
So he really didn't know what to think, but he was ordered to start a peace movement. But at the same time, they wanted money from this organization to be sent to them, because they said they had other contactees in Japan, in the Soviet Union, in the United States, and they had formed organizations which gave money to this group. So they obviously wanted money from him also.
Really? But there was other humans involved in this as well, you said?
Yes, of course. When you have a case like this, which is so fantastic, you must ask yourself, of course, was he simply a myth maker? Was he a drug addict? Or was there something else behind it? But I interviewed his wife several times, Gunvor, and she died in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
She also met these aliens several times and said, well, yes, he did work for these people, but she was very afraid of them. And she even when she talked to me several years after this, she's afraid to say too much. She really didn't want to reveal too much about what happened. She seemed afraid even many years after this had happened, which is rather strange, I think.
Obviously, there's more I want to ask you about this, but in a little bit here, Håkan, we're going to take a break, and then I want to carry on in the next segment and talk more about this and some other things as well. But overall, though, is it believable to you, the whole story? Could there be, let's say, that there's partial truth but additions to it, or do you feel that the whole thing is the real deal? What do you think?
In my book, I have put up five theories about this. Basically, I say, yes, he did. He was involved with a secret group or with someone, and he did some secret work for whoever these people were. But, of course, there are problems here. For instance, there could have been a sort of false flag operation, or it could have been a front for some other activity. I mean, he could have been involved in some international crime organization or espionage or something that this was a cover for something else. But I really don't know this, of course. He was involved with a group, whoever they were or where they come from. That is clear, because there were several people who can confirm this, and his wife, of course, confirmed it also. And there are so many other parts of this, which it's a long story, of course. So, yes, he did. He was involved in something secret. That's very clear. And I think he was involved in some secret group doing something, which I don't know what their agenda is, but it seems like some form of aliens were involved. But, of course, that's my theory. I can't prove it, of course.
Yeah, well, what a strange and interesting story this one is, though. And there are a few... It seems like the UFO stories we get in the early days, in a sense, if I can put it that way, Håkan, seems to be the most spectacular, and they seem to kind of simmer down into the classical gray abduction scenario more and more after the 60s and 70s in a way. I know there are some different stories out there as well, but interesting.
Yeah. This is very physical, and it's very concrete in many respects. And one thing I didn't mention was that he also claimed to have flown with them, with their craft, several times to bases they had, not just in the Bahamas, but in Mexico and in Central America. And my friend, who knew him very well, was so surprised that he was an ordinary man with almost no money, and in the middle of the winter, he suddenly had a very good suntan. So obviously, he had been away for several weeks somewhere doing something. And of course, if you were an ordinary worker in the 1960s, you didn't have much money. You certainly couldn't go around the world.
Right.
So someone took him somewhere or gave him money to do this.
Interesting. So obviously, these and many other aspects is some of the things I want to talk more with you about when we return after the break. But for our Swedish listening audience and those who are versed in the Swedish language, you can look into the book Främlingar på vår jord. This means strangers on our earth. And this is where would you recommend people to go, Håkan, to pick up a copy of the book, to read more?
Well, you can go to the nearest library. Many libraries in Sweden have this book, so you can order it from UFO Sweden, from our national organization.
All right, excellent. We're obviously going to link up your websites and your blogs. The AFU website is in English, obviously, primarily, right?
Yeah.
That's the Swedish section there, but yeah.
Yeah, basically, because we are working doing our work, basically international work. So that's it's in English, yes.
That's right. And then you have two blogs that we're going to link up as well. Is that something you want to mention right now as well for our Swedish audience, Håkan?
Oh, yes, that's quite right, yes.
So ufoarchives.blogspot.com, and then you also have a Google site, Ufologist 52. It's a somewhat more difficult URL, so I'm going to just link that up so you guys can check it out in the links below to the radio program. But before we take a short break here now, then, is there anything else you want to mention before we do that, Håkan?
Well, you can say on my homepage, you also have some English articles in English that could be interesting.
Ah, excellent. Okay, go and check that out as well then for some English stuff. I think primarily we have English audience here. That's why we do it in English. But we like to focus on the Swedish stuff, of course, because that's our home base here at the moment. So, okay, in regard, good stuff. Håkan, stay with us. We'll take a short break and we'll return with more after this. We are going to proceed to discuss Rickard Höglund's case, his third trip down to Bahamas, and how he actually ends up working for Lou Schessler, the mafia guy. He apparently also gets to drive the Men in Black-styled Cadillac vehicle that belongs to Lou. Very strange story. We run through some of the main theories of this case and, of course, see if it's the real thing or not. We're going to try to sort this out. We are also going to discuss another case, that of Gunvor and her husband who went down to Mexico for work purposes, who ended up in a strange encounter with people in well-connected circles down in Mexico, who claimed they actually had a UFO, a flying saucer. Gunvor's husband allegedly went on a trip on this thing while she stayed behind, and we talk about her testimony and how this experience changed her husband completely, dramatically. Stay tuned for much more. The second hour available in our members area. Log in or click subscribe to get access to this continuation and all our previous programs going back to 2006. All the details are on the website redicecreations.com. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Mike Cross on psychopaths and the problem with Sweden. After that, we have Marty Leeds, Sterling Allen, Louise Turing, Christer Johansson, Matt Stein, Stefan Molyneux, Jay Widener, J.J. Hertak, and Desiree Hertak, William Davis, Mark Weber, Mary Sean Young, Kurt Lindahl, Tom Horn, Dean Clifford, and Jordan Maxwell, to name a few. You're welcome to tune in again when we're back with more in just a few days. But right now, more with Håkan Blomqvist. Stay with us.